Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. While we may be most familiar with the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs, there have been exactly five mass extinctions in the history of life on Earth, catastrophic periods where biological diversity and the sheer number of living organisms on the planet were reduced by staggering proportions. In a new book called The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, Elizabeth Colbert of The New Yorker asks whether we are right now living in the midst of another mass extinction, one caused not by an asteroid or an ice age, but by us, the human race. Elizabeth, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm just going to throw this out there. This book didn't exactly make me feel very great about the human race.
I think that one of the points that I do try to make, and you can make of this what you will, is that a lot of our best qualities, our creativity, our inventiveness, you know, our interest in other people, and even our interest in the world, our restlessness, are tied to the ways that we're impacting the world and causing this mass extinction event. So you could say that that's happy, or you could say that that's unhappy. I'm gonna leave it to you. How's that?
Okay. Well, like I said, unfortunately, I guess I took the cynical view.
Okay. Okay.
So I was born into a world where many endangered animals were and are the norm. So I sort of grew up thinking that I guess that extinction is in some way a natural part of evolution. But you write that throughout most of history, it's actually extremely rare.
Yes, that is. I'm glad you brought that up because that is really one of the main points of the book. It's a very simple one. We are so inured to extinction. We read about it all the time that we just say, "Oh, that's, you know, just part of the way things are." And I've had people say to me, you know, point blank, "Oh, isn't this just the sort of the natural order?" And the important thing to realize is that extinction in the natural order, so, you know, understood over vast periods of time, the whole history of life, is actually extremely rare. It's got to be rarer when you think about it. It's got to be rarer than speciation. Then we see new species created, and we don't see new species popping up all the time.
Sort of like the birth rate is generally higher than the death rate.
Exactly. Otherwise, the planet would be depopulated, right? I mean, these are pretty basic mathematical concepts.
So what is the extinction rate now, and how does that compare to the sort of quote-unquote pre-Homo sapiens average?
Yeah, well, it's hundreds, perhaps thousands of times what scientists refer to as the background rate, and that background rate is different for different groups of organisms, and it's usually calculated just by going through vast databases of fossils and trying to figure out how long the average species lives. So, you know, in the case of let's say a mammal, you know, that might be a few million years that the average species tends to live. And we see now, as I say, extinction rates that are hundreds, perhaps thousands, perhaps in some groups even tens of thousands of times higher than they seem to be in the fossil record. And, you know, those are only unfortunately increasing.
So before we get, I guess, to this concept of the sixth extinction, I wanted to go back and look at the big five mass extinctions thus far. I said in the intro, most of us have sort of a basic impression about that great big asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs. But what about those other four? What are the stories behind those?
Well, you know, in a lot of cases, we're talking about events that happened tens, hundreds of millions of years ago. So they're sort of, you know, murder mystery cases with a very, very cold trail. But the first of these major mass extinctions was about 440 million years ago. And interestingly enough, that is the time when life was still really confined to the water. So that was a really devastating event for aquatic life, but not for terrestrial life, because there simply was no life on land. And it's seems pretty clear that that was caused by this weird cold event, a very sudden glaciation event that is hard to explain, but the world got a lot colder pretty quickly right at that moment. The most devastating of all of these events was what's known as the end Permian extinction, and that occurred about 250 million years ago. And there's a book that's been written about that extinction by a British paleontologist, and it's called When Life Nearly Died. It got very, very close, perilously close, to eliminating multicellular life altogether. So that was a really devastating event. And that seems to have been caused, and this is where some very, very frightening parallels occur to one, by a really massive outflux of carbon dioxide.
Well, I guess that makes me ask, you know, how do we this sixth extinction compared to, say, an asteroid or, you know, a glacial event?
Well, I guess the honest answer to that would be we're not exactly sure. But people are very interested right now, particularly in this and Permian extinction, precisely because there seem to be some pretty scary parallels here. When you emit lots of carbon dioxide really fast, as we're doing and as happened at the end of the Permian period, a couple things happen. First of all, as you say, you raise global temperatures because carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, so that just follows pretty naturally, you know, despite what some people would say about the debate over climate change. That's just really a pretty basic geophysical fact. So you got massive global warming at the end of the Permian. And also you get a phenomenon that's also sometimes called global warming's equally evil twin, which is a lot of CO2 dissolves in the oceans. And when CO2 dissolves in water, it forms an acid, carbonic acid. And it's a weak acid. You know, you drink it when you drink a Coke, that's carbonated water. But
we all know what happens if you drink too much Coke.
Exactly. And if you pour enough of it, into the water, you change the water, the chemistry of the water, and that's happening. That's measurable. That's observable. That's, you know, not debatable either. And at the end of the Permian period, you also got this massive event of what's become known as ocean acidification, and we are seeing ocean acidification now, and that's another parallel that's not a very happy parallel.
Pretty cheery stuff here. I'm speaking with Elizabeth Colbert, staff writer at The New Yorker and author of The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Now, I feel like I have to ask this for the sake of argument, but aren't Homo sapiens a quote-unquote sort of natural part of the world? And, you know, no matter how many species we are directly or indirectly responsible for their extinction, isn't that too, in effect, I guess, a natural part of life and death on Earth?
I think that, you know, becomes kind of a semantic question, I suppose. I mean, is an asteroid natural? You know, yeah, it didn't have any... It's not supernatural. How's that? So to the extent that, you know, we are organic beings, or the asteroid wasn't even an organic being, but, you know, to the extent that we're part of this ecosystem that's the planet, we depend on it, yeah, we're natural. But, you know, I'm not sure that really makes any difference at the end of the day. And in some ways, it's only all the more sobering because, you know, we are dependent on this system. We are very much implicated in the natural world, whether we choose to believe that or not. So when you set really massive changes in motion, you know, to your own home planet, you kind of have to be wondering, you know, where that's going to lead.
Well, I guess that same argument would say that if there was an extinction of the human race, that was also natural, which is not something we're probably too fond of thinking about.
Exactly.
So if this sixth extinction is already taking place, what kind of efforts are underway to catalog and archive species before they disappear, given that it sounds like for many of them, the damage has already been done?
Well, there are lots and lots of efforts going on. I mean, there are these, for example, just to give you one kind of effort that's going on, there are these like rapid assessment teams that go out into pretty remote parts of the world and try to catalog absolutely everything that's there, precisely with this idea of, well, who knows if we come back in 20 years, you know, what's going to be here. So that's, you know, just one effort. But there are massive efforts going on in all ecosystems, all parts of the world, really, to catalog what's there. But, you know, the problem is that it's a very, very time-consuming work and very, very specialized work. And there are a lot of species out there. We do not know how many species we share this planet with, you know, really even to an order of magnitude, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, you write about one kind of weird effort, I guess, freezing animals, like in sort of like Ted Williams' Head.
Yeah, exactly. That was a really interesting trip. I went out to San Diego to something called the Frozen Zoo, which, you know, sounds like a zoo, but really it's not the kind of zoo you'd really want to visit. And what it really is just a bunch of vats of liquid nitrogen. And in these vats are cell lines, right? So we can get cells to grow, you know, in a petri dish, basically, and then freeze them, put them into sort of a state of suspended animation. And some very, very highly endangered animals, and in one case, the cells of an animal that is now extinct are now, you know, and I use this term in quotes, living on in these vats of liquid nitrogen.
Scientists in Russia have talked about cloning a woolly mammoth. I was reading about this morning. Just one of several examples of a movement towards something called de-extinction. With all those still living species now on the endangered list, doesn't that seem a little odd to you?
Well, I think de-extinction is one of those ideas that really captures the public's imagination.
Yeah, but who doesn't want to see a woolly mammoth or a saber-toothed tiger?
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, count me in, you know, and when the woolly mammoth shows up, I'm going to be first to buy a ticket.
Oh, we can go together.
Okay, great. Yeah. But I do want to say that there are, you know, when you start to really look at the idea in any kind of rigorous ways, there are huge obstacles, both just technically, you know, we don't have any woolly mammoth cells around. We don't have any woolly mammoth, for example, in the frozen zoo. So you have to genetically engineer a woolly mammoth cell. And right now we are not capable of doing that. Then you've got to get, you know, that to become an embryo. You've got to get some other animal to carry it to term, right? Woolly mammoths don't just come full blown into the world. They have, you know, very long gestation periods. And then let's say you even overcame all of those hurdles. The point is made that animals are more than their genome, right? So like if you raised a human, if you could create a human, there were no more humans, you created a human baby, you know, that baby wouldn't really be human if it was raised in a tank. And ditto for that woolly mammoth. Woolly mammoths, you know, presumably had very sophisticated societies, just like elephants, and they had to learn a lot from their social group members. So, you know, what do you have when you have one member of a species? It's kind of a creepy thought.
Wow. Well, like I said, it's a tough conversation. Is it sort of too late to turn the tide?
Well, I think that, you know, we tend to always see things in these stark terms, like, okay, either all hope is lost or you know, everything's going to be fine. And I think, unfortunately, the truth is very much in the middle. It's not too late for, you know, pretty much everything that's still out there. It's obviously too late for those things, you know, that aren't out there anymore, of which there are, unfortunately, an increasing number every week, practically. But we're talking about turning a battleship, you know, that's headed in one direction right now. You know, you could argue that we're really sort of maximizing our impacts on the planet. We're changing the atmosphere. We're changing the chemistry of the ocean. We're moving things around that often in ways that often have devastating effects. We're, you know, mowing down the rainforest. So we're really doing all the things that on some level we know we shouldn't be doing. And we're probably doing a bunch of things, you know, that we don't even not even aware of the impacts that they're having. So we really need to do, you know, we'll be working on a lot of different levels to try to minimize our impacts. So I think a lot of damage has been done. A lot of damage is probably close to inevitable at this point, but a lot of damage is not close to inevitable at this point, and that is a choice that we still have to make.
Elizabeth Culbert is a staff writer at The New Yorker. Her new book is The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Elizabeth, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Up next on Word of Mouth, we kick off NHPR's series on higher ed, A Matter of Degrees, with the story of a cash-strapped student who set out to pay his tuition and wound up raising $1 million on one absolutely hideous website. Stay with us for that story when Word of Mouth continues.